Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps warns that it will target the source of any operation against the country in any place. Iran's foreign minister says the country is ready to work with the IAEA to resolve outstanding issues as long as the agency acts technically rather than politically. The Hungarian Prime Minister says EU sanctions on Russia have backfired and led to an energy crunch the bloc is struggling with. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps warns that it will target the source of any operation against the country, wherever it may be. The IRGC's deputy chief for operations says Iran will never allow the emergence of any threat near its borders. Brigadier General Anil Furushan said the recent artillery and drone attacks on Iraq's Kurdistan region were carried out as part of the same strategic approach. He added that the bases struck played the biggest role in the recent riots in Iran. Anil Furushan stressed that the IRGC attacks were legitimate defense and that Iran had previously declared that it would respond to such threats strongly and decisively. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran is ready to work with the International Atomic Energy Agency to resolve questions regarding allegations of uranium particles found at the undeclared sites. In an interview with Al Monitor, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Tehran will work with the IAEA as long as the agency addresses the questions technically and not politically. Tehran has insisted that its dossier and the IAEA must be shut before any agreement to revive the 2015 deal, which the US left in 2018, can be revived. The top Iranian diplomat said his country is not afraid of having face-to-face talks with the United States to revive the agreement known as the JCPOA. But he added that such talks should be in a game-changer in which Iran sees some gains. Iran slams the European Union double standard approach to human rights, saying this demonstrated by the bloc's over-compliance with US policies. Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Khani criticized the EU's, quote, deafening silence on US sanctions and the violations of Iranians' rights. He said the EU is in no position to express concern about the situation of human rights in Iran, when the bloc even denies medical supplies to Iranian children suffering from painful skin diseases. Bagheri Khani's report came from an EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, which criticized Iran for what he called disproportionate use of force against protesters. Protests broke out in Iran, in Iranian cities over the death of a young woman who died at hospital a few days after collapsing at a police station. They later morphed into attacks on security officers and acts of vandalism against public property and sanctities. The protests in Iran have reached levels where they no longer can be called protests due to rioting and vandalism. That involved the destruction of property like religious sanctities to the gruesome killing of police officers. There are suspicions about perpetrators, especially organizers and their backers, especially using anti-Iran propaganda campaigns on social media. The US and anti-terrorist cults like the NKO have been behind such activities for decades.
Tirana, Albania, a troll farm in action. All are working with one purpose in mind. But what is a troll farm? It's an institutionalized group of internet trolls aimed to interfere in political opinions and decision-making. Their target? The Islamic Republic of Iran. This troll farm belongs to the MKO terrorist cult. MEK's Albania troll factory promoted the opinions of MEK terrorist agenda, and that was regime change in Iran. It spread fake news and devoted itself to manipulate, provoke, and to shape the public's mind for rebellion acts of violence, and the destruction of property. Certain analysts, like Kenneth Timmerman and former CIA officer Paul Pillar, also believe that the terrorist cult hires protesters to shape public opinion in exile, or even protests overseas, like this one. Online writer Heshmat Alavi. He had gained popularity. He had posted plenty of anti-Iran articles, and his posts were making his presence known, retweeted quite often. His Twitter account resume claimed that he was a human rights and political activist, writer, and commentator on Iran and West Asia studies. At one point, he had become so popular that even the former U.S. President Donald Trump referred to him when it came to undermining the landmark JCPOA nuclear deal. The problem was, this person did not exist. The Intercept ran this headline. Described as an Iranian activist, he wrote dozens of articles for right-wing outlets. But is he a real person? It said the writer Heshmat Alavi pushed for regime change in Iran. But an MEK defector said the controversial, exiled opposition group created the persona. Former MEK member named Hassan Heirani, who helped manage the Alavi persona in Albania, told The Intercept back in 2019 that Heshmat Alavi was a person run by a team of people from the political wing of the MEK. They write whatever they are directed by their commanders and use this name to place articles in the press. This is not and has never been a real person. Yet plenty of people, including journalists and analysts, had fallen for him, including Forbes magazine, Al Arabiya, and The Hill. These so-called reputable outlets then used his information as a basis to spread propaganda and disinformation about Iran.
This particular set of data is revealing the activity of anti-Iran groups since the protests erupted. The graph shows the number of new Twitter accounts created per day in September 2022 from a sample of 43,000 tweets on the hashtag of OpIran. The number accelerated rapidly a few days after the unfortunate death of Mahsa Amini.
The MKO's fake Heshmat Alavi case was just one example of how Iran is consistently demonized and targeted. Just recently, two studies published this past August exposed how large numbers of fake accounts were spreading pro-Western and pro-NATO propaganda on social media, all the while demonizing U.S. adversaries such as China, Russia, and Iran. In the case of Iran, fake accounts attacked Iran and accused it of having too much influence. This propaganda included fake news alleging, for instance, that Iran was trafficking the organs of Afghan refugees. This anti-Iran network included accounts claiming to be independent media outlets. In short, these two investigations were part of a growing body of evidence showing how Western governments and their allies have weaponized social media platforms and have turned them into weapons in a new Cold War setting. A separate study also published in August offered further insight into how social media is weaponized to spread pro-Western propaganda. Titled Unheard Voice, Evaluating 5 Years of Pro-Western Covert Influence Operations, the report was co-authored by Stanford Internet Observatory and a famous intelligence company called Graphica. Graphica was notorious since it worked closely with the U.S. government, contracting with the Pentagon, DARPA, and the Senate Intelligence Committee. Although it is very limited in scope and it has clear biases, the document does show that they accused China, Russia, and Iran of being imperialist while praising the U.S. government. The report stated our joint investigation found an interconnected web of accounts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and 5 other social media platforms that use deceptive tactics to promote pro-Western narratives in the Middle East and Central Asia. What stands out is how the online platforms like Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and even media outlets like the UK government-funded BBC, allowed publication or even broadcast of these types of material, which included inciting violence. In the case of the BBC, Ofcom, the media regulatory body which prohibits any material which encourages or incites acts of violence, for example, blatantly ignored how the channel was encouraging Iranians to come out to the streets and to commit these acts of violence. So bad was the coverage that the Iranian Foreign Ministry summoned the UK ambassador to protest.
Lebanese workers and depositors tried to storm the parliament compound on Monday amid the country's economic crisis. Retired military personnel demanded better monthly pay, while depositors called on the banks to release their life savings. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh has more from Beirut.
The crisis hit Lebanon is once again a scene of angry masses. The parliament is back to meet and debate a new budget. Yet protesters see the budget being discussed as elusive.
Instead of putting together a budget which encourages development in agriculture, industrial production, and all fields in Lebanon, they want to impoverish the people and push them to die in the sea as they immigrate illegally. The government, which relies on debt, is being controlled by a mob, which is the Banks Association and the Central Bank. They should be held accountable for getting billions of dollars out of the country.
Banks reopened partially on Monday following a week-long closure in the wake of a wave of holdups. Depositors stormed at least 7 bank branches in the capital and abroad, demanding their trapped savings.
We know these banks, you know, where we invested our money. But unfortunately, they stole the money between themselves, and they plan, and every time they create a story.
One woman named Saleh Hafiz forced one branch to give her $13,000 of her savings, saying she needed it to pay for her sister's medical treatment. But she didn't take back her money on her own.
They left us no other choice. We encouraged Saleh, and we were with her when she held up the bank, because it was a humanitarian situation, and we will be with all the people who urgently need their money. Our government is rotten and corrupt, and so is the judicial system.
The government has been procrastinating while time is running out. The governmental institutions, including schools, are almost out of service.
The entire governmental sector is paralyzed. The workers, the military personnel, the ministerial workers, the public teachers, they all have rights and they can barely do their job. There's no health care, no educational assistance. The budget plan the parliament is debating today is unfair.
Lebanon's economic downfall began in October 2019. The Lebanese pound has lost around 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, but officials have failed to put in place necessary reforms. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Hungary criticizes the European Union for its massive sanctions on Russia, saying the bloc's punitive measures have backfired and caused great damage to the continent. Addressing Parliament, Prime Minister Viktor Orban called anti-Russia sanctions a source of economic troubles and soaring energy prices in Europe. Orban also warned of a prolonged war in neighbouring Ukraine and said Budapest needs EU funds for investments in the energy sector. The Prime Minister stressed that if Brussels fails to deliver the funds, Hungary will get them from other sources. Moscow has halted gas deliveries to Europe, citing technical issues caused by Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine. European officials blame Russia for using energy as a weapon. A coalition of right-leaning parties has won Italy's snap elections by a big margin. Giorgia Meloni, the leader of Brothers of Italy, the party which received the most votes, is slated to become the country's first female prime minister.
Largely predicted by pollsters, the Brothers of Italy party has won the most votes in Italy's snap election, leading a right-wing coalition to victory. The turnout for the general election was about 64%, the lowest percentage ever recorded, around 9 points lower than the 73% turnout for the 2018 general election. Brothers of Italy, a group founded 10 years ago by its leader, Giorgia Meloni, grabbed more than 26% of the vote, while its allies, the League and the more moderate Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia, received respectively 9% and 8%. Meloni said on Monday that a future center-right government would not betray the trust of the Italian people.
Questo è il tempo della responsabilità.
This is a time for responsibility. This is a time in which, if you want to be part of history, you must realize that we have responsibility towards millions of people who chose us. We won't betray it, like we never have.
Meloni's flagship policies include defending traditional social values, anti-immigration programs, and the reduction of taxes. Meloni is slated to become the next prime minister, the first woman in Italy who has ever been appointed to that position. The news that a coalition led by Brothers of Italy won a decisive victory in Italy's snap elections has been welcomed by far-right parties from across Europe. The Brothers of Italy has relentlessly advocated for a free Europe, including sovereign countries, and promoted traditional values and essentialist conceptions of gender.
Certainly it won't be an easy task for Meloni to reassure the EU, other international partners and the moderate electorate, and at the same time maintain a strong connection with international populist groups and a more radical electorate. I don't think Meloni will ever find a way to mediate between these issues. That's why I believe her policies won't be too bold.
Among the defeated coalitions in Italy's national elections was the Democratic Party, growingly seen by a large number of Italians as the party of the establishment. Its leader, Enrico Letta, conceded defeat early on Monday, adding that his party would be the largest opposition force in the next parliament.
It is evident that mistakes were made. I will lead the next party until the next Congress, when a new leader will be determined.
According to the Italian constitution, newly elected members of the parliament must now meet within 20 days. The country's president, Sergio Mattarella, will begin consultations on who should be appointed as the new prime minister with the presidents of the Senate and Chamber of Deputies, the leaders of the main parties, and, at a later stage, with parliamentary groups. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Religious minorities' role in 8-year holy defense. One of the conspicuous features of the 8-year holy defense of the Iranian nation against the Iraqi invasion in 1980s was the sincere and voluntary participation of religious minorities in the war against the invasion. A non-Muslim never feels as a stranger in Iran, thanks to the progressive and comprehensive constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Once Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon his soul, received representatives of various religions after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, saying that Islamic Iran belongs to all strata and minorities, hence both in legislation and execution of laws, their rights should be fully observed. The current leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, too, has followed the Imam in advising the officials to pay due attention to the rights and problems of minorities. Therefore, minorities have always taken part in every scene of activity since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. However, Christians have played a more significant and visible role due to their greater number among minorities. Religious minorities were present both in struggles against the despotic regime and the eight-year war, which had been imposed against the Islamic Republic by the U.S. and its cohorts in 1980s through their stooge, Saddam Hussein of Iraq. In one case of recruitments, 400 Christians were sent to the front voluntarily to fight the invading enemy. These Christian compatriots showed bravery and self-sacrifice, and many of them were martyred in the war. A notable number of them were also injured or captivated. Ayatollah Khamenei often pays a visit to the families of Christian martyrs at Christmas. In one of these visits, he said, "Christian minorities, whether Armenians or Assyrians, became proud in the revolution and war as a loyal, wise, insightful, and brave Iranian." Some of the Armenians were present in the battlefront till the last month of the war. Armenians offered 74 martyrs, 35 captives, and 105 war invalids in the way of defending the country and the revolution. The schools of religious minorities were the place of collecting assistance to the front, and their families would give different necessities fervently. Although followers of different religions have different customs and rituals, these differences couldn't cause rifts among Muslims and non-Muslims during the holy defense. Secretary of the Iranian Jewish Society said, "Iranians from every ethnicity, tribe, religion, and sect have made their common history. Mutual comprehension and brotherhood among Iranians has created a colorful picture which can be considered as a model for others. In our world, many long wars are being staged with various ethnic, racial, and religious motives. Yet, the Iranian nation stood against invasion like a single body and overcame them and taught unity, brotherhood, and resistance to the world people." The functions of the eight-year war were both effective in inducing identity and granting solidarity. The war caused religious minorities to participate in the fronts like other combatants. Imam Khomeini said to a gathering of Armenians, Assyrians, Jews, and Zoroastrians, "We are all under the flag of monotheism. As long as we do not convert, we won't be able to resist against unfaith. We have all got united under the banner of monotheism. Iran belongs to all, and monotheism is our religion. All believe in the beginning and resurrection, and we have these commonalities. We are a monolithic nation, and it is necessary for all to be present in the scene in the issues of Iran. We should be a single hand against those who want to invade us in the name of Islam or other religions. Let us cooperate to find a way to prevent oppression against all strata of world humans. Great prophets from Adam to the last prophet have come to hoist the flag of monotheism and justice among nations. After Imam Khomeini's speech, Mr. Sargent Beat Oshana, as the representative of all religious minorities, said, "Today, thanks to the revolution and the wise guidelines of the Imam of Ummah and the correct performance of top officials of the Islamic Republic of Iran, religious minorities enjoy freedom and brotherhood in this country, and their humane and fundamental rights have been guaranteed in the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they have no serious problem in their social life." After the invasion of Iraqi Baathist army, followers of all religions in Iran tried to take part in defending the territorial integrity of the country in one way or another. Their reaction and sentiments were very interesting and inspiring. A Zoroastrian martyr had written to his mother, "When you hear the news of my martyrdom, try to ease yourself through remembering the grief of all martyrs. People should see you prouder than before, but you can cry for me in your solitude. But do it in a way not to forget the people for my sake. I will be killed for people as my father was also killed for them." A Christian also wrote in his testament, "Dear compatriots, I lost my life in the way of independence of the country. Sacrifice in the way of the country was my ultimate goal. I expect all brave Iranians and God-worshipping Armenians to continue my path in the way of freedom and independence of the country." Jewish martyr Eshaq Tizabi's brother said while mourning for his 22-year-old brother, "Eshaq's blood, like the blood of other Jewish martyrs, will create unbreakable bond between Jews and other Iranian compatriots."
Food for thought.
Salam, dear listeners, and let us listen to a thought-provoking saying from the Prophet's 18th infallible heir, Imam Reza, peace upon him. "The worst earner of livelihood is that who deprives others of improving their livelihoods through his earnings." Thank you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Principles of Friendship. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. And in today's lesson, we are going to talk about principles of friendship. Friendship, as we know, is a very important part of life of any human being in life, because no matter every human being lives in this world, definitely grows up with his family, with his father and his mother around, with his sister and his brother around. But you see, with time, he got to connect himself, he got to have connections between him and other people that are not from his family. And those are the friends, those are the people that he needs to connect to. Those are the people that he needs to be with. For example, a friend is anyone that he could meet in a school, you know, in the area where he's studying. He could meet in a shop, he could meet in the places where he's going to play every time. Every time a child goes out, definitely he or she is meeting with other people or other children from the other families. So from there, the friendship grows. So friendship, in this case, is a very important thing in someone's life, because there's no way a someone can live in this world without having a friend in life. He needs a friend. He needs someone he could talk to every time. He needs someone he could play with. He needs someone he can talk with. He needs someone he can share his thoughts with. So with such need, with this much need in our lives, we definitely gonna have to look at the principles of such connection, because it's a connection. If it doesn't have the right amount of principles, if it's not conducted in the right way, definitely it's going to bring more harm than good. So we need principles to look at. We need guidance. Someone needs to be guided on how to be with his friends or her friends, and how he can, you know, bring out good in that particular relationship. So it's something we need to look at. It's something we need to be careful of.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRIB English Radio. And in today's topic, in today's program, we're talking about the principles of friendship. We've been talking about how important it is for someone to have a friend in life, and that it's a necessity for anyone to have a friend, someone he can talk to, someone he can share his thoughts with, someone they can sit down and talk with each other and share the thoughts and share jokes and everything. So a friend is someone you need in life that you must share with, that's not from your own family, that's not from your blood, that's not from your father or your mother. Because in that case, you'll need to have that particular person you're meeting with in your workplace, in anywhere you're going, in your business area maybe. You will definitely meet people from the other side of the world that you will become friends together. Now, what are the principles that we need to look at during this particular relationship of two people? Now, in general, we will talk about a few principles, but the main thing is for us to check on how we can be successful friends, for the people that we are friends to. You know, if I am your friend, how can I be a successful one? How can I make myself successful? How can this relationship between me and you be a successful relationship? You know, relations with others is definitely among the most important social art. And most of the people neglect this part of relation. Thus, you know, they fail in gaining friends and their relationship with others. Now, their relationship with others will be turned into problems and conflicts. This is because they lack, you know, the knowledge of seeking friends and how to deal with them and the principles of friendship. So indeed, the psychological studies and the day-to-day experiences, as well as the guidance of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his holy progeny, the 12 Imams alayhi wasallam, decorates us with guidance and ways of seeking friends and how to associate with them. So these are the principles that we are bringing in life in this particular relationship are supposed to be based according to the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad and his holy progeny. We need to look at how they used to deal with their friends. What did they say about friendship? What did they say about making up a good friendship? And from these particular teachings, we'll come up with the best principles of how we can improve our friendship. Thank you so much for listening. Until next episode, inshallah. Fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Delight.
Startup in Tunisia breathes new life into old shoes as artists restore and even customize the footwear. The new business is called Kenenti and is located in the capital, Tunis. Here, the team uses fabrics, laces, and leather recovered from various factories for the repair work. The creative artists work on every detail during each project, even the soles of the shoes. The work aims to find solutions to shoe waste and reuse items instead of adding them to the world's landfills. Cherif Zerroui is the co-founder of Kenenti. He says the idea came to him 2 years ago when he discovered the number of shoes thrown away each year in Tunisia.
In France, there were 100 million pairs of shoes thrown away every year. This is a huge figure for us, and for the ecosystem and for the earth. In Tunisia, it's almost the same given the population. There were 3 or 4 million shoes thrown away every year. So we thought of giving added value to these shoes, so we restored them.
Zerbui also says he is happy to create jobs for those willing to participate regardless of the educational degree. Besides shoes, these artists dabble in restoring worn-out handbags, giving them a brand new look. Many of the artists and interns say they are proud to be part of this unique project. They say they feel like a family there. The startup is the first trainer restoration business to be launched in North America. A free climber known as the French Spider-Man scales a 48-story skyscraper in Paris to fulfill a goal he set for himself once he reached the age of 60.
A few years back, I promised myself that the day I turn 60, I have to climb the total tower. Because 60 years old marks retirement age in France, and so I thought this would make a very good nod.
Alain Roberts says this building is not as hard as others he has climbed. The French Spider-Man has ascended over 100 of the world's tallest buildings, including the Sydney Tower, the Sears Tower in Chicago, and the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, amongst many others. Roberts says he spent 2 decades climbing mountains before attempting urban climbs. Using his rock climbing experience, he sometimes carries a small bag of climbing chalk to help him grasp the small protrusions of building walls. Many of his climbs can last several hours. The 60-year-old daredevil says he wants to give people the message that age is a number and one can still be active and do sports. A Palestinian farmer has discovered an ancient Byzantine-era mosaic when preparing to plant an olive tree on his plot of land in the Gaza Strip. The farmer and his son have been carefully excavating the area for 3 months since spring. The pair dug out three patches, revealing glimpses of an ornate mosaic with intricate images of birds, flora, and tile patterns. Its full size is roughly 23 square meters. The discovery has set off excitement amongst archaeologists. Experts say it is one of the most well-preserved specimens, with precision in graphics and richness in colors. According to archaeologists, the mosaic pavement dates back to the 5th and 7th centuries. Last month, another Palestinian farmer found the rare stone sculpture while working on his land, which dates back to around 2500 BC. They're back as India has revealed or released several of them into the grasslands of Kuna National Park after a 70-year absence in the country. The eight radio-coloured African cheetahs made the long journey from Namibia. The big cats were released during a ceremony by Prime Minister Narendra Modi that coincided with his birthday. After their acclimation in the national park, they will be released into a 5-hectare spread of land in central India, covered by grassland and forest. The felines will share the landscape with other animals and roam with leopards, sloths, and striped hyenas. Their reintroduction is the culmination of a 13-year effort to restore the species, which vanished from the country decades ago. Another 12 cheetahs are expected to join the fledgling Indian population next month from South Africa. With more funding, the country hopes to gradually increase the population of cheetahs to around 40. World Cleanup Day unites millions of volunteers, governments and organizations to tackle the global waste problem and build a sustainable world. People in several countries joined the efforts again for a waste-free world. Volunteers were seen in mangrove forests in the suburb of Bangkok. They collected more than 1.5 tons of rubbish in just a few hours. Trash picking events were also held in the Philippines and Vietnam. In Hanoi, hundreds, mostly students, armed with metal tongs and sacks, walked along major roads. They said their aim is to raise awareness about protecting the environment. In Manila, people cleaned up the city's beaches that are major tourist attractions. The annual cleanup day has been running for over a decade, from divers collecting marine debris to children picking up trash on beaches have just one goal: make our planet a cleaner place.
Chinese astronauts are celebrating their first ever mid-autumn festival in outer space while sharing their otherworldly experience with people on Earth. The crew had a close-up view of the moon from China's Tiangong space station and their third month in space. On the occasion, the ground crew organized a series of celebrations, including a family reunion for the astronauts. The ground crew also prepared elaborate food packages that had been prepared before the launch of the spacecraft. Typically, the traditional festival is kicked off by the first viewing of the full moon on the 15th day of the 8th month of the lunar calendar. Despite being able to see the moon rise and set 16 times a day, the astronauts say the moon is special on this occasion. Forestry authorities in southwestern China have opened a new canteen for wild Asian elephants in a bid to stop them wandering into villages. The canteen in Yunnan province provides the animals with attractive and nutritious meals while exploring man-animal harmonious coexistence. During these years, the province has explored multiple ways to reduce the encounters between humans and elephants and try to keep the animals away from farmers' crops. There are now approximately 1,400 hectares of dining halls for elephants, with many expanding from 100 to 240, such as corn, rice, and sugarcane. They are planted on a large scale and within easy reach of the elephants. The location of such canteens is extremely selective, usually away from villages and major roads, and the chefs are locals. Most of the time, you have to visit an exhibition to see art. But what if art comes to see you instead? Well, a group of artists in Mali have created a floating art venue that will travel up and down the River Niger. It's called the Pirogue du Zem, which is a floating vessel. It's designed to host plays, exhibitions, dance shows, and so much more. The idea is to make art a movable feast that is no longer restricted to fixed venues in cities and accessible to all people. The project was created by a local artist and architect who had a vision to bring art to the masses. The vessel is 20 meters long and 6 meters wide, built with storage and enough space for exhibition. Government officials say the floating venue will showcase Mali's talents and creativity while attracting tourists.
Colombia is known for its tourist attractions and is full of breathtaking natural sights such as beaches, mountains, deserts, and forests. The South American nation is also one of the few places that give tourists the chance to have an encounter with whales. Every year, from July to October, domestic and foreign tourists flock to Colombia's Pacific coast to catch a glimpse of humpback whales. The large animals reach the coast after traveling thousands of kilometers from Antarctica and southern Chile. But for visitors, there are strict rules to help preserve the area and the whales. Tourists are now being welcomed for whale watching after a two-year hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic. This is also the time when humpback whales start their reproductive process. Art restoration requires intensive research and training and loads of skill. But imagine the anxiety while professionals embark on restoring rare paintings. Under careful supervision, French restorers are working to give back to 500-year-old paintings their former glory. They were rescued from a fire that engulfed the Notre-Dame Cathedral in Paris in 2019. These works date back from the 17th and early 18th century. The paintings, including 22 with large format, were temporarily stored in a warehouse and now being restored at an undisclosed location. The fire caused strictly no damage to the paintings, but they have accumulated thick layers of dirt and smoke on the surface after hanging in the cathedral for centuries. Some of the works also have paint loss due to overcleaning that restorers say need to be repaired elegantly.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism.
Illegal hunting and hybridization with American crocodiles have for decades threatened their populations, with some species being on the verge of extinction. But there are some people who put their lives at risk to save the natural heritage. A Cuban researcher has released a baby crocodile that was confiscated from illegal hunters back into the wild. It was a happy moment for Etienne Perez, who went waist-deep in the dark water of Zapata Swamp to free Cuban crocs, the smallest known range of any living crocodile species. Cuban scientists were racing for quite some time to save the rarest crocodile. The government has protected virtually all of the vast swamp, widely considered to be the best preserved in the Caribbean. But the scientists say more efforts are needed to save the nature.
Releasing crocodiles seized from poachers is really impressive because we return the animal to a free life in the wild. In the case of the animals in the hatchery, we are trying to increase the historical range of the Cuban crocodile and, of course, increase the number of these individuals in the wild.
Cuban scientists estimate that around 4,000 crocodiles continue to live in the wild. But because the area they prefer within the wetland is relatively small, a climate-related disaster, increasingly common now globally, could wipe out the brunt of the population. They say illegal hunting for decades is also threatening crocodile populations.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The pillars of U.S. supremacy are shaking as emerging economies are developing in a rapid pace. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media to know their idea about this issue. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The website of Global Times said, the world today is undergoing accelerating changes unseen in a century and has entered a new phase of uncertainty and transformation. Human society has reached a crossroads and faces unprecedented challenges. Under these new conditions, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as an important constructive force in international and regional affairs, should keep itself well-positioned in the face of changing international dynamics and better assume its historical mission. Countries should enhance mutual support and work together to cope with complex changes in external environment. In today's world, conflicts are looming large between unity and division, cooperation and confrontation. The SCO is under great test in maintaining regional peace and security, and its member states face severe challenges in maintaining their own security and stability. Only by strengthening high-level exchanges and strategic communication, deepening mutual understanding and political trust, guarding against attempts by external forces to instigate color revolution, and jointly opposing interference in other countries' internal affairs under any pretext, can countries safeguard their security and development interests and hold their future firmly in their own hands. Countries should expand security cooperation and jointly uphold long-term peace and stability in the region. Over the years, with an eye on common security, the SCO member states have carried out practical and efficient security cooperation, which has ensured the overall security and stability in the region. Amid a complex and volatile regional security landscapes, it is all the more important to stay true to the vision of common, comprehensive, cooperative, and sustainable security and build a balanced, effective, and sustainable security architecture, constantly upgrade the level of law enforcement and security cooperation within the SCO, and strictly prevent terrorist and extremist forces from destabilizing regional security. Countries need to deepen practical cooperation to materialize a shared vision of development and rejuvenation. Common development is real development, and sustainable development is a good development. All SCO countries are at a crucial stage of development. They should leverage their unique strength of geographical proximity and intertwined interest. They should uphold the vision of innovative, coordinated, green, open, and shared growth to achieve integrated regional economic development, energize growth, vitality, and deliver a better life to their people. Countries should enhance people-to-people and cultural exchanges to consolidate public support for the long-term development of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Consolidate public support for the long-term development of the SCO. The most solid foundation for SCO's development lies in mutual learning among civilizations, and the most profound strength lies in people-to-people ties. They need to promote exchanges, dialogue, and harmonious coexistence among different civilizations, deepen cooperation in such areas as education, science and technology, culture, health, media, radio, and television, and build bridges of mutual understanding and amity between the people. Countries should uphold multilateralism and work together to make the international order more just and equitable. As a Chinese saying goes, power may win for the time being, but justice will prevail for the long run. Faced with power politics, bullying, and hegemonic practices, the SCO should assume its due international responsibility by safeguarding the UN-centered international system and the international order based on international law, promoting the common values of humanity, expanding SCOs exchanges with other international and regional organizations such as the UN, and improving global governance so as to make greater contributions to world peace and development. Over the years, with its own development, China has propelled the development of countries in the region